Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and I'm here to ask you a very, very simple question. When is an episode of the Empire Podcast not an episode of the Empire Podcast? And this is the answer, because this isn't a regular episode of the Empire Podcast, folks. No, this is an interim episode of the Empire Podcast. We took 2 weeks off over Christmas. We're not back with the regular show until January 13th. That is next week. But this week I was bereft. We had nothing to record. There was a big gap just waiting there on January 6th. And I needed something to fill that gap. And then I had a wonderful idea. Let's get Team Empire together to preview 2023. I don't think we've ever done this before. Old dog, new tricks, all that stuff. And so, therefore, we have convened in the pod booth three colleagues of such lethal cunning to talk about the films of 2023 and bring you an interview with Noah Baumbach, because I don't have anywhere else to put it.
What was that?
What?
Okay.
Anyway, those three colleagues of such lethal cunning are, as you've heard already, our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
All the way from Los Angeles, our West Coast correspondent, one of the greatest people on the planet. You know him as James White. We know him as Jaime Blanco. Welcome. Welcome in the flesh. How are you?
Hello. Thank you. I am good. I am good. Not jet lagged at all, which is nice.
You shouldn't be, because you arrived here about 3 weeks ago.
I mean, potato, potato.
And he's not in the studio today, but we're taking advantage of some super-duper technology to listen to him anyway. That's hope he is clothed and not masturbating. It is, of course, our great big fucking nerd, James Dyer.
Hello. I'm very excited to be a disembodied voice in your ears. I think our relationship should proceed like this going forward.
It really should. It really shouldn't, is what I meant to say.
There we go.
We need to have you in the studio from now on.
Or we can keep an eye on him.
Keep an eye on you, precisely. I thought we did a big old review of the year just before the year ended. That is tradition. We do that every single year. And I thought, we don't really look ahead to the year ahead. So I thought, let's get together and do that. But let's not do the usual rote, let's go through the year month by month thing. So I got you all to come up with top tens, the top 10 films that you are most excited about this year. Now, I will say this, there will be some overlap.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are some films we're all excited about. All right?
Yeah.
I will also say this.
Me and James have the same number one.
I imagine that you do. For balance, your number one is not my top 10.
I didn't think it would be.
I love the first one.
Sure.
Love the first one.
Sure.
We're talking about Hubie Halloween, right?
Murder Mystery 2!
Murder Mystery 2!
Oh my God! You're genuinely... Let the record show that Chris is genuinely rewriting his top 10.
Oh my God!
Right now. I saw that on the list of films coming out this year and I thought, Chris is going to mention that. Well, I was wrong until this very moment.
Well, we have a new... I've just written Rural Juror. Murder Mystery 2. Fuck me, catastrophe averted. Jesus.
Here was you thinking that The Equalizer 3 was the only film that was rocking your world next year, but no.
That's right. My top 10 films of the year list is actually only two films, Equalizer 3 and Murder Mystery 2. Everything else can go hang as far as I'm concerned. But yes, I love the first one. We'll get onto it in a second. And I'm very much anticipating the second one, but there are a few other films that I'm anticipating just a little more, a smidge more. The second thing I wanted to say before we get into this is that Megan doesn't count, because Megan is out next week, the first masterpiece. And I may even go this far, by the time the year is over and the dust has settled, the only masterpiece of 2023 will be Megan. So therefore, that is not going to be on anyone's most anticipated films list. So
just because it's too close.
It's too close. It's too close. It's too close, Helen. A bit like White Noise is a bit too close, don't you think?
Segwaying.
And before we get into our top tens for the year, why don't we look back? Why don't we look back a little bit at White Noise, Noah Baumbach's latest movie, which is currently streaming on Netflix. And Helen, you interviewed Noah Baumbach, didn't you?
I did. For the very final day, really, the very final release day of last year. So really, it's a wrap-up of 2022.
And it's a wrap-up.
A look ahead to 2023, in a manner of speaking.
Well, I think thematically this fits quite beautifully.
Super well.
Quite beautifully.
Not shoehorned at all.
Not shoehorned, and this isn't an episode that I have created out of whole cloth just to house the Noah Baumbach interview. And I'd like to thank you to keep your accusations to yourselves while you're listening to this wonderful interview that Helen did with Noah Baumbach, director of White Noise, available now on Netflix to enjoy.
To my shame, I hadn't read this book, so I had no idea what to expect, and the film kept surprising me and surprising me. When did you first come across it? Is this something you read years and years ago and sort of returned to?
It's something I read. My dad had given it to me in the late 80s, and I read it when I was a sort of older teenager and loved it. And then there are various sort of images from it that had stayed with me over the years, the pill and the cloud and the motel and the man in the motel and the secrets. But I didn't have any ambition to do anything about it. I randomly picked it up again and started reading it again at the end of 2019 and into the beginning of 2020. And while I was reading it, I kept reading passages aloud to Greta and saying, like, can you believe this? I just felt like it was expressing all of these things that I was feeling about life now. I mean, it's life always in America, I think, but there's something about the book that feels like it could have been written after any event. You'd be like, I can't believe this is, but of course, when the pandemic happened, it was just another layer of strange uncanniness about that book that felt like it was that it was speaking. It certainly was speaking to me about the moment, and I felt like there's a way I could express myself in a movie that express how I was feeling through this story.
Yeah, because it does. It feels incredibly contemporary for something, you know, set and written in the 80s, and you've got all these ideas about, you know, consumerism and the media and this kind of rolling continuous media that feels absolutely now. It feels absolutely up to the minute, which I guess is just a sign of how good Don DeLillo is. But you know, I didn't expect anything like this going into it. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's like everything you said is only amplified, louder now.
And even the portrayal of academia as the sort of, you know, competing for students almost, that feels like that has only grown and grown mm-hmm. in the years since this was written as well.
Yeah, and academia in some ways is another way of commodifying culture and flattening out meaning. You know, I mean, it's that you could find a situation where Hitler and Elvis are sort of mean the same thing in some way.
Yeah. I mean, that is an incredible scene in the film with you know, simultaneous Hitler and Elvis lecture going on. If I saw one review that described it as competitive, but at the same time, it almost felt cooperative and like a duet almost, that they're sort of playing off each other.
Yeah, and we choreographed it that way as well, so that it was like a dance and like a duet. Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the movie was choreographed. That scene, it's more expressive and more out front. But all the scenes with movement, we choreographed in a similar way, so that there was a kind of dance and song that was embedded inside the sequences.
So I mean, I know that another part you choreographed apart from the dance at the end, which I want to talk about because that was amazing, but was also the family scenes and that sense of a big kind of rambunctious family all tumbling over each other with ideas, physically tumbling over each other, getting breakfast and everything at the same time. That felt wildly true to me, having come from a family of four kids myself. You know, that also had to be kind of quite carefully choreographed, I think, just to get that level of of maybe ease with each other. Is that right?
Absolutely. And rehearsed, and we rehearsed it on the sets as well, because I wanted everybody to know what's their glass, you know, if, particularly the kids, like which McDonald's glass do you use? Which one's yours? Which one's yours? Where is the silverware? Which way does that cabinet open? You know, things that are somewhat simple, but they are part of our routines. When we go into our own kitchens, it is like a dance. We know exactly where everything is. We know how to get around each other. We're, you know, you're not bumping into each other. You're in this flow of life. And the first part of the movie in particular is about that flow of life and about these routines and these rituals and ultimately these strategies that we have for ourselves so as not to confront ourselves in many cases. And but I think there's also real beauty and joy in that as well. And I wanted to express that in the movement and in the dialogue. We mic'd everybody individually so that I would have the freedom later to isolate dialogue or play it all as one sound.
Just one chaotic
noise. Yeah, one chaotic sound. I also, my direction to the kids essentially was, you're like a radio that's been turned on at the beginning of the movie, and you're going to be on for the whole movie. And whether you're in the scene or not, just assume you're still talking. And when you come back in, you're just in the middle of one long conversation.
Yeah. From some of the interviews I read with Greta, that very much happened. They would just go straight from dialogue into their conversation, back into dialogue.
As real people as well. They would, between when we were cutting, they would go out of the dialogue of the movie and then just start talking about whatever they were talking about, and it would have the same song would be playing.
That's awesome. So tell me about these different parts of the movie, because that has got to have been, I imagine, the most difficult part of the adaptation process. Is this is a big book. It's a book full of big ideas, and you've got to try and boil this down into movie length, basically.
Right.
How do you, where did you start? What did you decide to focus on as your kind of through lines?
Well, yeah, and of course, in the beginning, when I was adapting the book, that everything in the book was so exciting to me and funny and observant. So I had my first pass would include so many different things, and it's really once I got through this first sort of chunk of screenplay, then I could look at it as its own thing, and then I could start working the screenplay. And at that point, it started to become more my thing or my interpretation now of the book. So then things would reveal themselves to me more as either unnecessary or superfluous or repetitive in a way that I felt I didn't need. And I would then start excising things, combining things, and then inventing even within that. But as a result, then there's so much good stuff that's not in the movie. I mean, and I would go back to the book occasionally later if I was looking for something, or I remembered something maybe I cut, I thought I could put back or something. And then I would be rereading the book again and be like, God, there's so much good stuff. I didn't, why is this not in the movie? Why didn't I pick that? But it becomes its own thing. And I felt like you just follow what feels like now the movie.
So you could do White Noise 2 with basically all the other bits.
All the other bits, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I do want to talk about just the way it's shot as well, because you've got the sort of the disaster sequence in the sort of the middle of the movie felt very Amblin to me. It felt very kind of 80s, kids, family action movie, mm-hmm. if you like. And then you have this fantastical, brightly lit, beautifully colored dance scene at the end. So you really, it felt like you were experimenting with things and just letting yourself be led by the moment. Is that fair?
Well, it feels that way, although it was all very planned. but I'm glad it feels that way. Well, the book felt that way to me, and the book uses tropes of American narratives, culture, language, and it does it in a very literary way. And I felt like my job was to find these cinematic analogs for those things. And a lot of it was the language of these movies, and often movies from the 80s, because it's when it took place. It's also a formative time in my childhood of when I was discovering movies sort of on my own. And as opposed to things my parents maybe brought me to, much of what the movie's about is how we absorb all of this stuff from entertainment, and sometimes it becomes hard to distinguish between what's on TV and what's really our lives. I mean, that you see it with the family in the movie, where when real danger is coming, they somehow can't, it takes them a long time to acknowledge it. The kids are ahead of it, but the parents are sort of feel like, well, this can't actually be happening. This is only something that happens somewhere else. And I think it's something certainly I related very strongly to, that feeling with the pandemic, which was, well,
can't happen here.
Yeah, it's not happening over here. It's happening somewhere else. And so I felt, well, this is a way I can express, you know, that sort of, I mean, how we, you know, just, I mean, I think it really, one of the things the movie is really about is sort of this changing idea of death. I mean, this idea that we have that death is, we make part of our entertainment. It's the car crashes in the beginning of the movie. It's watching a plane crash in New Zealand on your television. And it becomes hard to really, you know, it's hard anyway. And this is a way that we maybe bring it closer and also keep it at a distance. And when it really comes in the form of the cloud, it changes how they all go back to life. You know, I mean, and can you go back to the same strategies and rituals that you did before? And if you can, how does it change those things? And does it change those things? And in the movie, it does. And, you know, and it changes visually. The camera changes in part three. We shoot the family in the supermarket in the beginning of the movie. We essentially just move with them. It's fairly straightforward when we're with them in part three, both times that. And then, of course, at the end with the dance sequence, the camera suddenly does things that it couldn't possibly have done before. It's sort of liberated in a way. And I think that's part of what I see too is, I mean, there's a cynical way of looking at it of sort of like, oh, we're all just going back and shopping. But there's also, I feel, real beauty and joy and liberation in that we've been also something that has released us from, you know, maybe this sort of prisons that we've sort of made for ourselves. You see it with the family too. The family, essentially death is what keeps them apart and also what brings them together in the end. And Jack and Babette are closer, but they've also gone through a lot to get there and had to go into areas that they, you know, may not have wanted to go to.
Yeah, and taken some odd steps along
some odd
the way.
Steps and almost killed a man.
But, you know, it's fine. They got him to a hospital.
They got him to a hospital and they're back at the supermarket.
I just thought it was so original. And like I say, just unlike anything I'd ever seen before. I have to ask just quickly before I let you go, you know, your household has also been working on a Barbie movie. Do you see any kind of common threads between that and this?
I do, actually. I mean, they were both written in the pandemic. And I think in the best way, both have a touch of madness in there that was maybe particular to our headspaces at that time.
And a bit more choreography there, I think, as well.
There's also choreography in both, yeah. I mean, essentially, both have are kind of like musicals in a sense, even when they're not literally like musicals.
Can't wait for that one. And thanks again for this one.
That was Noah Baumbach, director of White Noise. And tell you what, if he had a film out this year, it would be high on my most anticipated films of the year list, along with Helen dropping stuff. What did you just drop?
I just dropped my phone. Sorry. We're trying to...
Dropped me.
To,
you dropped me.
No, I'm trying to
Ouch.
Make... I'm trying to make it so there's not a light shining in your face.
James is on Zoom right now, zooming in. Let's start with Blanco.
Yes.
Well, I was actually going to segue from Baumbach, if I'm honest.
Okay, all right, Mr. Baumbach-tastic.
Because a film that I suspect may not be on all of your top tens, but should be.
Yes.
Is by his partner in crime, if you will, is by Greta Gerwig, and it is Barbie.
That's on my list.
I thought it would be on some list. I don't think it's maybe on all three of your lists.
It's not my list because I knew it would be on your list. And also, yeah. I don't know how much I'm looking forward to it. I'm a little scared of Barbie.
Scared, you know, confused, definitely, intrigued for sure.
Aroused?
I mean, maybe a little. They're all very good looking people.
They are all very good looking people.
But I'm mostly just amused. I have no idea what this film is and I cannot wait to find out.
If it's
half as good as the trailer, I think we're in for an absolute treat.
If it's half as long as the trailer, we're in for a treat.
If it's half as long as the trailer, it might not be worth the money. But if it is half as good as the trailer, we're going to be in for something special. And wasn't it Simu Liu was persuaded to sign up for it because his agent said it was genuinely the best script he'd ever read?
Well, sounds good to me.
I mean, you know, agents are not necessarily known for their 100% fidelity to the facts. Mm. However, you know, those are strong words, and I'd like someone to hold him to them.
And also, apparently, it's only a minute and a half long. So, there you go. Jimbo, it's on your list?
It's on my list.
You're not Jimbo Blanco. You're Blanco. Jimbo.
Jeez. You call me Jimbo sometimes. It's confusing.
I never call you Jimbo. I have never called you Jimbo. When have I called you Jimbo? Tell me one time. You can't. All right, Jimbo, in your weird wank dungeon.
Oh, no.
What? You said naked podcast. I'm here for the naked podcast. I'm disappointed to see you're all wearing clothes.
So you're excited about Barbie, but I'm very, very glad to see it's just cinematically.
I was about to say, you're saying I'm excited, presumably from what I'm saying, not from how I look. But yes, I am. In fact, I've numbered my list. My list is numbered. I have a numerical list. So I wasn't sure how we were going to do this. We're going to count down. Barbie is at my number six.
Okay.
It is at my number six.
Yep, good.
Yes.
Good. Where is it then, yours, Helen?
I think it was five.
Five.
I can't get the list up because I've got Zoom open. We can see James. Sorry.
I've replaced the list.
Zoom troglodytes.
I sent you the list.
You can do both. You can do both.
You can do both.
You can do both. All right. All right, I'll do both. Blanco, is Barbie on your list?
Barbie is not on my list, not because I am not looking forward to it. I very much am. It's because, like you,
I hate women.
Figured... I'm not even going to answer that one. Minefield, stepping away. It was more that I figured it would be on Helen's list for sure, so I thought, let's have some variety.
Unbelievable. What is number 10 on your list?
Number 10 in my list, somewhat fittingly, I think, is Fast X.
Oh.
Fast 10.
Fast 10, your seatbelts. Dom Toretto is coming to the movies once again. Not on my list. That's how disappointed I was by Fast 9. And let's be honest, we've been on a downward curve since Fast 5.
Yeah.
Which admittedly was the pinnacle of all human achievement.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to go up from Fast 5, isn't it? But I still love Fast 7. I had issues with Fast 9. I'm excited about Fast 10, but for the same reason as you, it didn't make my top 10.
To make your top X.
Hey, indeed.
Yeah, but yeah, it should be a ton of fun. But no, it didn't move the needle for me.
I mean,
it's fair, but given Fast 9, which I should probably not talk about too much anyway, because people seem to hate it. But it's sort of the casting of Fast 10. People like Jason Momoa, Brie Larson, people like that could be a lot of fun.
Good people,
it should be a lot of fun.
Is this going to be the year of Brie? Because she is also in The Marvels, of course.
Yes.
Which is a film I'm very, very much looking forward to. I'll say that it and Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania didn't make my top 10 list. But again, Ant-Man's so close. I didn't want to cram it full of MCU films. But, you know, it's a given.
Yeah.
It's an MCU film. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. And seeing Iman Vellani back as Ms. Marvel will be a treat. So I think that'll be really good fun as well.
Yeah, and we don't know where that movie is or where it's going to take place or who's going to be in it.
Nope.
We know that's the one we know least about this year in terms of the MCU. We know a fair amount about Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. I may or may not have spoken to some people involved with that film recently, and I know a little bit about it, possibly, allegedly. And that's very, very exciting. You know, very visually different from the first two Ant-Man movies. No Sonny Birch, which is in the demerit column, but in the merit column, everything else. So could be a lot of fun. The Marvels looks great. I know nothing about it, apart from it's got three Captain Marvels.
Yeah.
But it feels like a second chance to me. Like, I really liked Captain Marvel as a character. I thought she was great. I thought that first film was patchy. And I think it had some pacing issues.
Good last act, but it, not so good before then.
Exactly that. And so I really want to see that character get a second stab at this. So I think she was really good in Infinity War and Endgame, or rather in Endgame, I should say, not even Infinity War, because we don't count the post-credits scene as really being in it. But, you know, I like that character. I think she's fun. And I want to see how she interacts with the other Marvels as well. So, yeah, this was up there. Like in my MCU, I only put one MCU in my top 10. Again, for the same reasons I think that you did. I didn't want it to be a big Marvel fest. But also there is one I am excited about above all others.
Which is?
Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 3.
Okay, I'm just going to mute Helen for a second.
Hey, I didn't say
none. On account of them being the greatest Marvel team of all.
This is true, until Thunderbolts comes along.
Indeed.
When you sing Ghost and Red Guardian banter, oh, that's good. It's even I can't get excited about that one. But anyway, I will. In the fullness of time, in the fullness of time, I will be excited about it.
What do you mean? It's going to be all Val all the time. Everyone's excited about that.
Yeah, that's what everyone wants.
I like Red Guardian.
I like Red Guardian. I like funny. Ghost.
Yeah.
I like Bucky Barnes.
I like Bucky.
I like. Yeah, I know you like Bucky.
Bucky.
I like Yelena. I like Yelena Belova. And I like many of the other people who are in that film.
Cool.
I can't remember.
So that's
anyway,
it's going to be good. But they're not the Guardians.
No, they're not the Guardians.
And it's Drax's last hurrah, as we now know for definite, as he said in his recent interview with, was it GQ? It was GQ, wasn't it? Yeah.
Very good interview, actually. People should read it.
Yeah. And I love Drax and I love the whole team. And while I may not have been hugely enamored with the holiday special, for it was a bit slight, I'm very, very psyched about this.
I love the holiday special. I just didn't like volume two, but I'm hopeful that volume three will be at least as good as the first.
But you're right. Yeah, but I'm with Helen on this. I think Volume 2 is a flawed movie, but I think it's flawed because of the main story, not because of the characters. And I think I really enjoyed spending time with the characters and had lots of fun with them. It was the whole ego storyline that just bored the tits off me. So I think having those characters and actually having a really compelling story, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I mean, assigning value to these things when you're putting a top 10 list together is utterly arbitrary, but it was number one on my list, which is impressive given that we're also in a year where there's a new Mission movie and a new John Wick and a new Adam Sandler. But
two of those three appear on my list also. On either side of Barbie, in fact.
You're excited about Murder Mystery 2, Helen,
three,
as well.
Four, five. That was not the one.
I like that. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Anywho, yeah, I'm massively looking forward to this. I've said this before. We did a big Guardians holiday special, spoiler special, which was also a breakdown of the teaser trailer for Volume 3, and I think this movie is going to break me, quite honestly. I love these characters so much, and we're going to be saying goodbye to a few of them permanently, I think. Obviously, we'll see. I put money on a few of them being in Kang Dynasty and Secret Wars. You know, I would be amazed if Chris Pratt wasn't around in the long term. But a few of them, I think, are going to be for the choppy block in a Wild Bunch style-y, and it's going to be tears all round.
Maybe they're just going to go and live on a farm like Bucky. Who did literally go and live on the farm, remember?
That is actually true. You were
all convinced he was going to die, and I was like, no, he's going to go up and live on a farm upstate, and I was pretty much 100% on that. So
that's right.
They're just going to go live on a farm.
Blanco, I'm going to stick with you again. What's number nine on your list?
Number nine on my list is a little film I like to call Cocaine Bear. Partly because of the trailer, partly because I have seen a little bit more of it. just a bit, one scene. I went to an event in the old Los Angeles there where they showed the trailer, and then they showed a scene which is basically, they basically take half of it and use it for the trailer. It's the ambulance scene, essentially. But it's bits before and sort of just after that. And honestly, it looks like an absolute blast. It looks like so much crazy fun. And I like the idea that Elizabeth Banks is basically creating a revenge story for the bear. She feels so bad about the real-life bear who got into the cocaine and unfortunately died.
It's a cautionary tale to all bears,
it is,
isn't it?
It is.
Don't do drugs, bears.
I mean, Winnie.
What Williams said for bears,
Rupert,
cocaine is God's way of saying that you have
too much money.
And bears should be definitely aware of that.
They should.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, featuring bears on rampages. If it's Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, or Cocaine Bear, give me Cocaine Bear every single day.
All right. I still prefer Marmalade Bear. If I'm honest, I believe he has another name, but that's what I call him, Marmalade Bear.
Funny enough, Cocaine Bear is my gamer tag. It's interesting.
I think most films this year would be improved by the injection of cocaine into both the movie and the title. Wouldn't you rather go see Cocaine Dune Part 2?
No.
No?
No, I'd rather...
Cocaine Barbie, I mean, on the other hand.
It's kind of,
cocaine,
you know... Well, okay, that's intriguing. But Dune already has a drug going on. You don't want to compete with true. The Spice Melange, do you?
Spice Bear is a film I'd watch.
Cocaine Spice John Bear. Wick. Who wouldn't see that film?
I mean, I think it's already implied.
I feel like it is.
Anyway, all right, good. Is Cocaine Bear on your list, Helen?
It's not. It was a close call, actually. I went in the end for... Possibly because I'd been reading that same GQ interview with Dave Bautista. I went for Knock at the Cabin. No, I read... the book The Cabin at the End of the World recently, and it's a fantastic story. It's really great. All the word on him, not just in that article, is very good. And I'm kind of intrigued to see how on earth they put that on screen. So I'm optimistic for that one. So this is my number nine, a
couple, two guys and their young daughter.
Yep.
Who go off for
a lovely break in an idyllic cabin, I think by a lake in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then several strangers knock at the door and say, well, I don't want to even say what they say. I think the less you know about it going in, the better.
I'm very intrigued by this because there's been people are slightly up in arms on Twitter about this because the name change from A Cabin at the End of the World.
Mm, which is a better title.
To Knock at the Cabin.
Which is a bad title.
People think that the author of the book, Paul Tremblay, has been erased somewhat in this. Now, I wonder if that title change is significant. Who knows? We shall see. But that should give you an idea of what realm we're in here. But I'm intrigued. I really love the book. If the film follows the book, it's going to be a very interesting film. It's not on my list because I think
it's quite soon,
but also he's a little bit.
This is M. Night Shyamalan.
M. Night Shyamalan, and he has been a bit all over the place of late.
True, so. Yes. I know, but I'm keeping the faith with that one. I'll be honest. There's some optimism. Do you want to hear more of a sure thing?
Okay,
which is on my list. Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yes,
Scorsese is on my list now. Regular listeners may know that the reason I really want to see this is I don't understand the budget and I am fascinated to see where the money went. I cannot wait to see how this film that you could absolutely make for $2 million was initially budgeted at $200. I cannot wait. So I am absolutely fascinated to see that. But it is also, great, great sort of fertile ground for Martin Scorsese. He's, of course, assembled an amazing cast led by DiCaprio and De Niro, my God, to lead it. So it's very exciting in its own right. But also for me as a nerd, I need to know. I must know, man.
I think it was Jesse Plemons. His rider is enormous.
That would make sense.
Well, as we always say, when life gives you Plemons, you make Plemonade. That's one of the big Oscar movies. And when I was looking at the release schedule, the big Oscar stuff, like the big heavy hitters, there's a David Fincher film, The Killer, not a remake of the John Woo film, but a thriller, nevertheless, starring Michael Fassbender. You try and think of the big...
Yay, Fassbender's
traditionally,
back.
Yeah, but he's back also in Taika Waititi's Next Goal Wins, which is finally
also on my
being
list.
Released.
Yeah, also
really.
On my list, yeah.
The long delay in that movie is making me less excited about it. I have to say, it does feel like maybe it's not a winner.
Look,
but
that would be thematic if it wasn't, but I feel like Taika Waititi has had other things on his mind, on his plate, not least, of course, Thor and about a million other projects that he's been developing and, you know, getting married and all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it could have other reasons than quality to be delayed.
I like that you're willing to embrace the optimistic every day is Christmas Eve, after all. But really, the big heavy-hitting Oscar films haven't been dated yet.
No.
Some of them may even still be being made right now. So this is going to be a much more commercially-minded list, commercially-driven list. We're going off stuff that has been dated for the most part. There are things that are on my list that haven't really been dated. Murder Mystery 2 hasn't been given an official date. I don't know when that's coming out.
Well, because Netflix.
Netflix. There are a couple of things that are going to be coming out this year. Two huge action movies that I'm really, really excited about. Matthew Vaughn's Argylle, which is a spy movie, which, you know, I've heard very good things about. And then there's Gareth Evans, you know, for my money, the greatest action director on the planet, returning to the action genre with a film called Havoc, starring Tom Hardy, and that's on Netflix. Hasn't been given a date yet, but if you're not excited by the idea of Gareth Evans and Tom Hardy breaking some heads and shooting some fools, then honestly, I don't know what to do with you. In my opinion, it should already win Best Picture, and I haven't seen any of it. But the big Oscar bait hasn't been dated yet. No. But we know The Killers of the Flower Moon is coming out this year, so that's also one I'm very much looking forward to. Jimbo, what about you? We haven't heard one from your list for a while.
Should we start with number 10? So this is the lowest on my list, but in many ways the most important, and it is Dungeons and Dragons, yes. Colon, Honor Among Thieves, for yes. so many, many, many reasons, partly because it's D&D, so it is inherently brilliant. Also, it's got Pine, it's got Rodriguez, it's got Rae-Jean Page in it, but also, and Chris, you will appreciate this, mm-hmm. it's obviously John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein, mm-hmm. directors of The Immortal Game Night, aka mm-hmm. one of the best comedies ever made. So, wow. And this, the trailer of this
who are
just
you?
Destroys me.
Who are you and what have you done with
I this? Love Game Night. I absolutely love Game Night, and I loved the trailer for this, and, you know, while in many ways for me, nerdery like D&D is no laughing matter, I think it's good. I think it brings a nice charming take on Dungeons and Dragons, which will make up for the previous ones.
Fully agreed. You know my opinions on Game Night. I think it's the best, certainly mainstream comedy of the last 10 years. I think it's astonishing. Blanco seems perplexed.
I'm mostly perplexed because Game Night is, and let me just get this straight, it's a comedy?
I know. Yeah. I don't understand.
Yeah.
James, I'm unpredictable.
This is not your traditional territory, though I know you have your moments.
Oh no, he died.
Yeah, it's the greatest line reading in cinema history. It's incredible. Yeah, I've seen a couple of clips from this movie, and it looks very, very funny, and it goes left, and you think it's going to go right, and so on, which is the Goldstein and Daly way. So I'm very, very excited about this one.
That was
indeed,
very close
but again,
to my list.
Not my list. Mm. How's about?
I mean, it's great that we go from Cocaine Bear to Owl Bear also.
Yeah, oh, very good. There was indeed an owlbear in the trailer, which I was very, very pleased to see. Wow. Well, while we're doing sort of like name recognition, I will say that you may have chosen Killers of the Flower Moon, but I would argue that the better moon is, of course, Rebel Moon, which is Zack Snyder's film, yes. which is like Seven Samurai in Space, aka Battle Beyond the Stars, aka Sofia Boutella recruiting warriors from planets to defend some colony somewhere. And I want to see it. I need to see it in many ways.
Yes. I'm very excited about this one as well. All two parts of it.
Yeah, I forgot that was this year, actually. Yeah. That's intriguing. Yes,
it's going to be later on this year.
Yeah.
And yeah, good choice. That was a good choice, Jimbo. Two good choices. Two left-field choices. Blanco, have you got a left-field choice?
I've got a potentially left-field choice, although I think it's a fairly straightforward choice. It is Renfield.
Renfield. Me too.
Yeah.
Renfield.
I'm interesting.
Really quite looking forward to it. I was already kind of on board with the Nicholas Hoult of it all because he's really earned my respect in things like The Great and obviously The Favourite and many things that man has done.
The Menu recently.
The Menu most recently, yeah. And then we have the Nicolas Cage element. Nicolas Cage's pop art Dracula, which honestly I cannot wait to see. Mm. I think the trailer is dropping today as we record mm-hmm. this, so I cannot wait to see it. It'll be out by
what
the time you listen to this. I will be crushed.
Yes, Chris, edit this bit out if the trailer is terrible. But right now, we're super excited about Renfield.
Super excited.
I mean, it's just got so many things I'm excited about. I think Chris McKay is a funny director. I like Lego Batman. And it's got Awkwafina in it, and she's pretty great in a lot of things that she does. So I'm absolutely on board for this. I think it could be really good. I realize it's the 79,000th version of a Dracula story, but I think it'll be a nice spin on it. And I want it to be great.
Also stars Shreya Aghdashloo, a.k.a. Christian Avasarala from The Expanse. So it's instantly a five-star film.
I mean, okay. Hey, speaking of The Expanse and therefore space and therefore sci-fi, how about 65? That's
How
number
about
seven 65? On my list.
That's the lesser known sexual position.
What is 65? I'm going to look it up.
65 is the Adam Driver versus dinosaurs
yes.
with a ray gun.
I don't think remember that in the Kama Sutra. Although I think it would satisfy everybody, am I right?
We're all doing the Adam Driver with a ray gun.
Well, it's just, I mean, this is something I was actually talking to someone about yesterday. Why don't more movies have dinosaurs in? Like, everybody True. Likes a dinosaur. Why aren't we putting dinosaurs in more movies? Why is Jurassic Park the only major live-action franchise with dinosaurs regularly eating people? And, you know, and 65 may offer us an answer, a solution to that dilemma by having dinosaurs eat people, again, in a non-Chris Pratt-related way. So I just think it looks like a giggle, and I hope it is a giggle. And of course, it brings us back to White Noise, Noah Baumbach's film. It's yet another reason to put that interview at the start of this episode.
I might put it in again now. Here is Noah Baumbach.
Talking about 65.
Talking about White Noise. Do please enjoy.
To my shame, I hadn't read this book, so I had no idea what to expect, and the film kept surprising me and surprising me. When did you first come across it? Is this something you read years and years ago and sort of returned to?
It's something I read. My dad had given it to me in the late 80s, and I read it when I was a sort of older teenager and loved it. And then there are various sort of images from it that had stayed with me over the years, the pill and the cloud and the motel and the man in the motel and the secrets. But I didn't have any ambition to do anything about it. I randomly picked it up again and started reading it again at the end of 2019 and into the beginning of 2020. And while I was reading it, I kept reading passages aloud to Greta and saying, like, can you believe this? I just felt like it was expressing all of these things that I was feeling about life now. I mean, it's life always in America, I think, but there's something about the book that feels like it could have been written after any event. You'd be like, I can't believe this is, but of course, when the pandemic happened, it was just another layer of strange uncanniness about that book that felt like it was that it was speaking. It certainly was speaking to me about the moment, and I felt like there's a way I could express myself in a movie that express how I was feeling through this story.
Yeah, because it feels incredibly contemporary for something, you know, set and written in the 80s. And you've got all these ideas about, you know, consumerism and the media and this kind of rolling, continuous media that feels absolutely now. It feels absolutely up to the minute, which I guess is just a sign of how good Don DeLillo is. But, you know, I didn't expect anything like this going into it. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's like everything you said is only amplified, louder now.
And even the portrayal of academia as the sort of, you know, competing for students almost, that feels like that has only grown and grown mm-hmm. in the years since this was written as well.
Yeah, and academia as a, in some ways, is another way of commodifying culture and flattening out meaning, you know. I mean, it's that you can find a situation where Hitler and Elvis are sort of mean the same thing in some way.
Yeah. I mean, that is an incredible scene in the film with you know, simultaneous Hitler and Elvis lecture going on. If I saw one review that described it as competitive, but at the same time, it almost felt cooperative and like a duet mm-hmm. almost, that yeah. they're sort of playing off each other.
Yeah, and we choreographed it that way as well, so that it was like a dance and like a duet. Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the movie was choreographed. That scene, it's more expressive and more out front. But all the scenes with movement, we choreographed in a similar way, so that. That there was a kind of dance and song that was embedded inside the sequences.
So I mean, I know that another part you choreographed, apart from the dance at the end, which I want to talk about because that was amazing, but was also the family scenes and that sense of a big kind of rambunctious family all tumbling over each other with ideas, physically tumbling over each other, getting breakfast mm-hmm. and everything at the same time. That felt wildly true to me, having come from a family of four kids myself. You know, that also had to be kind of quite carefully choreographed, I think, just to get that level of maybe ease with each other. Is that right?
Absolutely. And rehearsed. And we rehearsed it in on the sets as well, because I wanted everybody to know what's their glass, you know, if, particularly the kids, like which McDonald's glass do you use? Which one's yours? Which one's yours? Where is the silverware? Which way does that cabinet open? You know, things that are somewhat simple, but they are part of our routines. We don't, when we go into our own kitchens, we, it is like a dance. We know exactly where everything is. We know how to get around each other. We're, you know, you're not bumping into each other. You're in this flow of life. And the first part of the movie in particular is about that flow of life and about these routines and these rituals and ultimately these strategies that we have for ourselves. So as not to confront ourselves in many cases. And but I think there's also real beauty and joy in that as well. And I wanted to express that in the movement and in the dialogue. We mic'd everybody individually so that I would have the freedom later to isolate dialogue or play it all as one sound.
Just one chaotic noise.
Yeah, one chaotic sound. I also, my direction to the kids essentially was, you're like a radio that's been turned on at the beginning of the movie, and you're going to be on for the whole movie. And whether you're in the scene or not, just assume you're still talking. And when you come back in, you're just in the middle of one long conversation.
Yeah. From some of the interviews I read with Greta, that very much happened. They would just go straight from dialogue into their conversation, back into dialogue. When
as real people as well. They would, between when we were cutting, they would go out of the dialogue of the movie and then just start talking about whatever they were talking about, and it would have the same song would be playing.
That's awesome. So tell me about these different parts of the movie, because that has got to have been, I imagine, the most difficult part of the adaptation process. Is this is a big book. It's a book full of big ideas, and you've got to try and boil this down into movie length, basically.
Right.
How do you, where did you start? What did you decide to focus on as your kind of through lines?
Well, yeah, and of course, in the beginning, when I was adapting the book, that everything in the book was so exciting to me and funny and observant. So I had my first pass would include so many different things, and it's really once I got through this first sort of chunk of screenplay, then I could look at it as its own thing, and then I could start working the screenplay, and at that point it started to become more my thing or my interpretation now of the book. So then things would reveal themselves to me more as either unnecessary or superfluous or repetitive in a way that I felt I didn't need. And I would then start excising things, combining things, and then inventing even within that. But as a result, then there's so much good stuff that's not in the movie. I mean, and I would go back to the book occasionally later if I was looking for something or I remembered something maybe I cut, I thought I could put back or something. And then I would be rereading the book again and be like, God, there's so much good stuff. Why is this not in the movie? Why didn't I pick that? It becomes its own thing, and I felt like you just follow what feels like now the movie.
So you could do White Noise 2 with basically all the other bits.
All the other bits, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I do want to talk about just the way it's shot as well, because you've got the disaster sequence in the sort of the middle of the movie felt very Amblin to me. It felt very kind of 80s, kids, family action movie, mm-hmm. if you like. And then you have this fantastical, brightly lit, beautifully colored dance scene at the end. So you really, it felt like you were experimenting with things and just letting yourself be led by the moment. Is that fair?
Well, it feels that way, although it was all very planned. but I'm glad it feels that way. Well, the book felt that way to me, and the book uses tropes of American narratives, culture, language, and it does it in a very literary way. And I felt like my job was to find these cinematic analogs for those things, and a lot of it was the language of these movies, and often movies from the, a lot of movies from the 80s, because it's when it took place. It's also a formative time in my childhood of when I was discovering movies sort of on my own. And as opposed to things my parents maybe brought me to, and much of what the movie's about is how we absorb all of this stuff from entertainment, and sometimes it becomes hard to distinguish between what's on TV and what's really our lives. I mean, that you see it with the family in the movie, where when real danger is coming, they somehow can't, it takes them a long time to acknowledge it. The kids are ahead of it, but the parents are sort of feel like, well, this can't actually be happening. This is only something that happens somewhere else. And I think it's something certainly I related very strongly to, that feeling with the pandemic, which was, well,
can't happen here.
Yeah, it's not happening over here. It's happening somewhere else. And so I felt, well, this is a way I can express, you know, that sort of, I mean, how we, you know, just, I mean, I think it really, one of the things the movie is really about is sort of this changing idea of death. I mean, this idea that we have that death is, we make it part of our entertainment. It's the car crashes in the beginning of the movie. It's watching a plane crash in New Zealand on your television. And it becomes hard to really, you know, it's hard anyway. And this is a way that we maybe bring it closer and also keep it at a distance. And when it really comes in the form of the cloud, it changes how they all go back to life. You know, I mean, and can you go back to the same strategies and rituals that you did before? And if you can, how does it change those things? And does it change those things? And in the movie, it does. And, you know, and it changes visually. The camera changes in part three. We shoot the family in the supermarket in the beginning of the movie. We essentially just move with them. It's fairly straightforward when we're with them in part three, both times that. And then, of course, at the end with the dance sequence, the camera suddenly does things that it couldn't possibly have done before. It's sort of liberated in a way. And I think that's part of what I see too is, I mean, there's a cynical way of looking at it of sort of like, oh, we're all just going back and shopping. But there's also, I feel, real beauty and joy and liberation in that we've been also something that has released us from, you know, maybe this sort of prisons that we've sort of made for ourselves. You see it with the family too. The family, essentially death is what keeps them apart and also what brings them together in the end. And Jack and Babette are closer, but they've also gone through a lot to get there and had to go into areas that they, you know, may not have wanted to go to.
Yeah, and taken some odd steps along.
Some odd steps and almost killed a man.
But, you know, it's fine. They got him to a hospital for atheist nuns. They got him to a
hospital and they're back at the supermarket.
I just thought it was so original. And like I say, just unlike anything I'd ever seen before. I have to ask just quickly before I let you go, you know, your household has also been working on a Barbie movie. Do you see any kind of common threads between that and this?
I do, actually. I mean, they were both written in the pandemic, and I think in the best way, both have a touch of madness in there that was maybe particular to our headspaces at that time.
And a bit more choreography there, I think, as well.
There's also choreography in both, yeah. I mean, essentially, both have are kind of like musicals in a sense, even when they're not literally like musicals.
Can't wait for that one. And thanks again for this one.
All right. So that was Noah Baumbach again, talking about White Noise again. And very much looking forward to White Noise 2 when it comes out next year. I'm going to say a film now.
Do it.
Go on.
I'm going to say a film. Just look at my list. The list is life. Hang on.
Oh God, it's going to be The Equalizer 3, isn't it?
It's not going to be The Equalizer 3. It's going to be Wonka.
Wonka. It's Wonka. Not on yes. your list.
Okay. You have the wrong Timothée Chalamet film on your list.
I am here for anything Timmy Two Meats does, as you guys know. I'm here for anything Paul King does, the director of the original Cocaine Bear, Paddington and Paddington 2. And this is a movie that he's chosen to make instead of Paddington 3. So ergo, that gives me good vibes. He's also co-written it with Simon Farnaby once again, so that's exciting. That's and this will really true. Excite James. It is a musical, uh-huh. an original musical, a Wonka prequel. Now, ordinarily, that's an eye roll. Mm-hmm. I get it. Mm-hmm. But the music is from the genius that is Northern Ireland's sixth most brilliant person. I'm obviously number five. Neil Hannon, a.k.a. The Divine Comedy. And I am very, very excited about that. James is also a fan of that band.
He can name many of their songs many, just oh, right many. Now. He's
all
he's
of
about
their
to.
Songs. He's I enjoy all of the songs from them. Yes, they're very good.
Like, for example?
All of the songs. No. Like for example, the song entitled Song.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I do not enjoy the Divine Comedy, but I also can't name any of their songs. So
you're an absolute disgrace. Yes, I'm very, very excited about Wonka. Number nine on my list is the film that was most recently on the cover of Empire magazine, and it is Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny,
which may include dinosaurs. Helen, we don't know.
That, I mean, it could, and that would be awesome. No, I'm hopeful for this one. I think it's promising. I think that trailer, gave me a little bit of a zhuzh about it, and our cover story indeed as well. I think it looks really, really intriguing. So, yeah, I went from being very wary to being rather hopeful for this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, the title would indicate that this is some sort of sequel or maybe even a prequel to Tenacious D in The Pick of Destiny.
Absolutely.
So if this movie begins with Harrison Ford saying, "A long as fucking time ago when I don't go kaboo," I'd love that. That'd be amazing.
You just hold out hope of that. Yeah.
It would be a choice. It would be a choice if Indy suddenly bust out a swear-ridden rock song. That'd be incredible. But yeah, anyone else? Blanco, are you excited about Indy returning?
I am.
For the
I
last
am.
Time?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, less that it's the last time, but I'm quite excited by this after, you know, it's been a long time since The Last Crusade. Mm. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to having Indiana Jones back on my screen. I really can't wait to see what they've done with it. I have to admit, the whole let's de-age Indy idea sort of gave me vague pause, but then I see it a version of it in the trailer. I think that's actually pretty
good. It looks
good.
Great. Yeah.
Do you know who else has got fake paws? Cocaine Bear. So.
We've moved on to Owlbear. Come on.
Oh, sorry, my mistake. I'm excited about this. Be interested to see what they do. It's been 34 years since the last Indiana Jones film. Mm-hmm. Can they recapture the magic? We will find out when it's out later on in the year. And speaking of, we're running out of time, so I'm going to talk really quickly. Speaking of action icons trying to recapture the magic one last time, it's time for me to mention it. The Equalizer 3. It's happening, and there's nothing you could do to stop it.
And I'm sure it'll be fine. I mean, speaking of action icons...
Helen?
What do you want me to say?
Helen?
It's an Equalizer. Like, you're the only person...
You are.
Who cares?
I'll watch it, and I'll happily watch it.
I'll totally watch it. You know,
it's no John Wick Chapter 4.
Exactly.
So.
It's no Dead Reckoning, is
Listen,
it?
Listen, I'm going to watch it for the first time, and the only disappointment in it for me is that I don't get to do it twice.
Yes.
When Denzel's going to go into that room, it's a reunion with Dakota Fanning. It's Man on Fire 2 as well
true.
As the Equalizer.
Yeah. His art is death.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Denzel's art is death, and he's about to paint his masterpiece.
I think he's great. I think he's great.
This
love
is going to make virtuosity look like heart condition.
Virtuosity.
So anyway, John Wick Chapter 4, though.
Yes!
Come on!
Come on!
So this is, we think, the penultimate.
We think, yeah.
Yeah.
But we don't know for sure.
No. Might depend on how much money it makes.
I interviewed Chance Tehelski for the recent preview. And I was like, are you ever going to make a film at some point that's not a John Wick movie? And he was like, well, I've got plans. He's attached to Highlander and whatnot. But he said, I've got plans. But Keanu and I get together every couple of years. We make these batshit insane movies in which we can cram in all kinds of stuff onto the studio radar, thematic stuff, stuff that he's obsessed with. He's a big art nerd. He's very, very smart dude, Chad Stahelski. Mm. We basically have Kate Blanchett to
they
do whatever
Blanchett,
we want. So why wouldn't we keep on doing these? for as long as we possibly can.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm excited about John Wick Chapter 4, Donnie Yen.
I mean,
yeah, I just need to stop there. But I mean, Scott Adkins, much, yeah. isn't it? Yeah. Donnie Yen, Scott Adkins. You have Bill Skarsgård is in it as well. Very, very exciting indeed. How's John Wick going to bounce back from literally bouncing back onto the pavement after taking a tumble off the continental roof? Spoiler alert! At the end of chapter 3. Oh, it's exciting.
Cannot wait. Cannot wait. Yeah, that's very, very high on my list.
Is it the action movie of the year for you that you're anticipating though?
Well, so the top of my list is very action heavy, apart from Barbie. Because I also obviously have Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning up there.
Part one.
Same.
Part one with Tom Cruise throwing himself off everything. And I'm super, super hyped about that because, you know, that team has not put a foot wrong in recent years. There will be action also in Dune.
Dune!
There we go.
Part two!
Which is going to get pretty, pretty epic, I think. And Sandworms on the attack. Come on.
Okay, so talk me through this because obviously I haven't read James Herbert's Dune. I'm trolling. I haven't read Frank Herbert's Dune, so I don't know. Is the second part action heavy? Have they stopped before the good stuff?
No. So he's got to train as a Fremen.
Well, of course he has.
And sort of integrate himself into that culture.
I've been drinking my own shit for years.
Okay, that's not quite how that works, but okay. Whatever does it for you, Chris. But he also then has to essentially get his own back, innit? And fight the forces of essentially the entire galaxy to a standstill.
Mm-hmm. Does he go to Khazad-dûm?
Yes. In a manner of speaking, just not literally. But yeah, it's genuinely going to be pretty epic. And in ways that the first one was criticized for not being. I think.
Yeah.
Well, the first one was
very lightly criticized. There was a little bit of like, it could have had a bit more action, but this is going to have a lot more action.
Blanco, are you looking forward to Dune Part 2 before James filibusters the rest of this podcast?
I am indeed looking forward to Dune Part 2. I'd like it known to listeners who don't actually get to be in the studio, whenever the cry of the D word happens, it's extremely painful in the ears. And I mean Dune, not any other D word, just Chris, thank you. I am excited by Dune Part 2. I think it's going to be great. I think the first film was beautifully brought to life. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I don't think this team can fail because you're adding people like Florence Pugh. You're adding all sorts of
Christopher Walken.
Walken, for crying out
Cuthbert,
loud.
Cuthbert, Dibble and Grubb.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, they're incredibly expensive, but yeah.
They really are.
It's going to be pretty epic.
It's going to be so
very exciting.
I am excited, but I knew you guys would take care of it in the top 10, so yeah.
There is one other film on my list we haven't discussed, but I'll let James go.
There is another. I think I'm thinking, Helen, that our top 3 might be identical.
Mm.
So that was...
What have you got?
Well, because I had at number 3, John Wick Chapter 4.
Right.
And number 2, Dead Reckoning. And number 1, obviously, 2!
My number 2... I haven't mentioned yet. That's the one I haven't.
Oh, okay. A wrinkle in time.
A wrinkle in time.
That would be a great movie. Not what it was. It's a great movie. Great book. My number 2. That sounds wrong.
If you didn't like the film, you should definitely read the book.
In the number 2 position. That sounds wrong too. Oh, anyway,
yeah. We've gone 65 again. It's Adam Driver with a ray gun.
In second place, Spider-Man.
Yes.
See, that's not on my list. Not on my list. Like, I'm excited to see it, but I'm not quite as orgasmic about it as obviously others are. Like, I very want to see it, but it's in the same way that I want to see Quantumania and I want to see the Marvels. Really want to see it, but it's just not in my top 10. It is no Dungeons and Dragons.
Honestly, I'm super excited about Dungeons and Dragons, but like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was one of the greatest animated films ever made and one of the greatest superhero films ever made. And so,
steady.
Second best superhero film of that year?
Yeah, it's... Well, look, I don't want to get into
third best.
List.
I forgot Ant-Man and the Wasp came out that year as well.
Good God. Anyway, it's a very, very, very good film and I am very, very excited to see what they do next because it kind of does feel like they're, you know, they're making the right decisions to kind of push the envelope even further.
Yeah, absolutely. They're big fans of envelope pushing, which is actually really boring. If you do it in real life, if you get an envelope and push it, it's not that exciting. Wouldn't recommend. Blanco, where do you stand on Spider-Man? On his head, so he can't see you, obviously, but...
That seems very mean. I am very excited for Across the Spider-Verse, which I believe will have Sonny Birch in it, because, you know, Multiverse can do whatever they like. Maybe not, but...
Don't you fuck with me. Don't you fuck with my emotions.
Got to raise your hope and then crush it. I can't wait to see what they do. Again, it's people who've proved themselves in the first film to be absolutely blooming brilliant. And I don't see how they screw up the second one, although let's wait and see. Mm. Let's hope not. Let's hope not. One other film I wanted to mention, because mm-hmm. we haven't mentioned it yet, and I'm not sure it's on anyone's list but mine, but it's Shazam, Fury of the Gods.
I really like the first one.
I like the first one. I love the first one. I'm a big fan of the director. I think Zachary Levi knocked it out of the park as the lead. I think the kids were charming, and it's got Helen Mirren and Lucy Liu as the bad guys.
And Rachel Zegler.
And Rachel Zegler. What's not to love about that?
Not to love?
The trailer has a Fast and Furious joke in it to Helen Mirren, who is in the Fast and Furious films.
Yes. So, you think she had to be reminded of that?
She likes doing those films.
She loves it.
She has a good old time.
Yeah.
You don't think she's gone full like Gwyneth? Which, was I in it?
No. She literally named her character after one of her mum's friends as a kid.
Really? Yeah. I think she's very much like, oh yes, the bald fellow with the gravelly voice. I remember now. Which one? There were several bald fellows with gravelly voices in that project, as I recall. Yeah. That's an interesting
move. Genuinely hopeful it's going to be great. I mean, I want all the films to be great, and mm-hmm. I think Shazam Fury of the Gods could be a lot of fun. I thought the first film was a heck of a lot of fun, so I'm mm-hmm. looking forward to it until it inevitably gets completely removed from the timeline by DC's future. We'll see. It'll be fine.
Is Aquaman 2 the other one that's on your list, Helen, by the way?
We've gone through my entire list at this point, but I mean, look, I actually rewatched the original Aquaman the other night, and it is a ton of fun.
Why?
Admittedly, it's not good, but like,
no, it's not.
He's got such kind of joy in his own physicality. Like, there's such a sense of kind of, yeah, just pleasure in everything he does that it kind of is infectious and carried me along. And there's this freaking squid or octopus playing bongos.
There is. Okay, we're really, really in the home stretch now. But this is or was going to be a big year for the DCEU. Mm. Now things have changed post James Gunn, Peter Safran, who of course, ironically, is a producer of Shazam, Fury of the
Gods.
And
Aquaman.
And Aquaman as well. But so he's kind of happy, I guess, Safran, to put that part of his career and his legacy behind him and make it into a legacy. Because The Flash is also out this year.
We'll have to wait and see.
But, you know, we'll have to wait and see whether it does get... tax write off the movie might be a cracker. But listen, it's exciting. Michael Keaton back as Batman. I'm there for that. Ben Affleck as Batman, I'm there for that. We shall see what happens. But we're gonna really, really quickly... Have we mentioned your number two yet?
Spider-Man.
Is there anything on your list that we haven't mentioned?
Nope, I have gone through it.
Anything on your list we haven't mentioned?
I have Oppenheimer, which is
So in the war of the opening days, are you going to be Oppenheimer then Barbie or Barbie then Oppenheimer?
It's going to have to be Barbie then Oppenheimer all the way. Yeah. Let's be honest, I have to show my loyalty to Greta Gerwig.
Yeah.
There's just no other way. I'm sorry, there's just no other way. Sorry, Chris. Love you and think you're a great director, but Greta wins.
Right now in his home in LA, Chris Nolan has taken off his headphones and thrown them down.
Damn you, Blanco!
Unbelievable. It's the last time I listened to this podcast. All right. Oppenheimer, yeah, very, very excited about that. And also a big role for Robert Downey Jr., one of his first post-MCU. So excited about that. And I'm going to mention, real quick, Creed 3.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I love both Creed movies. I think they're great. This is very interesting for a number of reasons. Michael B. Jordan is directing it as well. It is the first Rocky movie to not have Rocky in it at all. So how will that work? Will we miss Sly Stallone? Will we miss Rocky Balboa? And of course, it's Jonathan Majors as his opponent. Yeah. And this is...
Villain of 23.
This is the Majors year for Jonathan Majors. Yeah. He is Kang in Ant-Man the Wasp Quantumania. I still have a sneaky suspicion we're going to see him in at least one more MCU movie, and not to mention some of the TV shows that are going to be coming out this year. I would not be amazed if he were in the Marvels, for example. We shall see. So I'm excited about that one. I'm excited about, let me see, Indiana Jones mentioned Murder Mystery 2. Yeah, sure. Obviously, that's my most anticipated film of the year. I can't wait to see insert name of Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston's characters here back together again, solving another mystery. This is the movie The Glass Onion could have been, and
unthankfully isn't.
Very excited about it. Genuinely, though, if you haven't seen Murder Mystery, it's on Netflix right now. It is a ton of fun. But the other movie I'm going to mention is Evil Dead Rise.
Of course, yeah. That was a bit scary for me. I watched the trailer and was like, okay, I'm scared. I'm too scared to put this on my list. but it is a very scary trailer.
I had to confess today to our very own Ben Travis that apart from Army of Darkness, I don't like the Evil Dead films. Chris, I'm sorry. I know this is where our friendship ends officially, but I just don't.
I'm going to try something. James, keep talking. It worked. James has left the podcast. No, he's back. That was ungroovy, Jimbo. That was ungroovy. Sorry. My apologies. Yeah, I'm Twitter of late, film Twitter, seems to have embraced the Fede Alvarez. It's not a remake, but the reboot quill of Evil Dead as a classic that's worthy to stand alongside the others. I'm not there yet, but I might be there with this one. We shall see. The trailer came out yesterday. It looks really good. New, different, in a tower block, possessed mother, possessed kids, chainsaw action, some wild looking shots. Sam Raimi not directing this one, obviously. This is Lee Cronin, the Irish filmmaker. But yeah, I'm going to hold out hope. I'm going to hold out hope that this is one of the belters of the year.
Amen,
indeed.
Well, we have hope for all of them.
We have hope every day. And many, Christmas many Eve. More. Indeed. And there will be many, many more films added to the list over the next few months as well. But those are the most anticipated films that we are looking forward to right now. And on that note, that is it for this impromptu 2023 preview. Thank you so much for listening to it. We'll be back next week with the regular show and, of course, our live show at King's Place, our 550th episode. Tickets for that are on sale right now. Go to kingsplace.co.uk. It's on February 2nd. That's a Thursday. On the evening of that day, it's going to be an absolute belter, folks. Less than a month. Ha! But it'll be an absolute belter. So if you want to join us for that, go along to kingsplace.co.uk to pick up the tickets. But in the meantime, it is time to say goodbye to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning, all the way from Port Stewart, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo. I'm here, though. I'm here.
All right. Yeah, sure. Of course you are. Hologram technology has really come on leaps and bounds. All the way from his wank dungeon in Redacted, it's James Dyer.
Goodbye. I'm off to do a 65 with Adam Driver's ray gun.
Oh, my God.
Where are you going to put the dinosaur?
Oh, my word.
Don't tell me.
Oh, my word. Thankfully, my vision is based on movie. No, that doesn't matter. And it's goodbye from Blanco, all the way from LA.
Farewell until probably next year.
Oh, such a shame. Such a shame. But now you can dial in.
Yeah. So please put me on the podcast more. Please.
No.
All right. And it's goodbye from me as well. You know what I'm off to do, folks? I'm off to listen to an interview that Helen did with the director of White Noise, Noah Baumbach, when he came into London for the LFF back in October. The film is, of course, based on the unadaptable book by Don DeLillo. Noah Baumbach took that challenge personally, as he discusses here in this interview with Helen O'Hara, which you're going to listen to now. So that's our parting shot to you. Have a great start to the year, everybody. And here it is, the dulcet tones of Noah Baumbach. Do please enjoy.
To my shame, I hadn't read this book, so I had no idea what to expect, and the film kept surprising me and surprising me. When did you first come across it? Is this something you read years and years ago and sort of returned to?
It's something I read. My dad had given it to me in the late 80s, and I read it when I was a older teenager and loved it. And then there are various sort of images from it that had stayed with me over the years, the pill and the cloud and the motel and the man in the motel and the secrets. But I didn't have any ambition to do anything about it. I randomly picked it up again and started reading it again at the end of 2019 and into the beginning of 2020. And while I was reading it, I kept reading passages aloud to Greta and saying, like, can you believe this? I just felt like it was expressing all of these things that I was feeling about life now. I mean, it's life always in America, I think, but and it has that, there's something about the book that feels like it could have been written after any event. You'd be like, I can't believe this is, but of course, when the pandemic happened, it was just another layer of strange uncanniness about that book that felt like it was that that it was speaking. It certainly was speaking to me about the moment, and I felt like it was, there's a way I could express myself in a movie that express how I was feeling through this story.
Yeah, because it does, it feels incredibly contemporary for something, you know, set and written in the 80s. And you've got all these ideas about, you know, consumerism and the media and this kind of rolling, continuous media that feels absolutely now. It feels absolutely up to the minute, which I guess is just a sign of how good Don DeLillo is. But, you know, it's, I didn't expect anything like this going into it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like everything you said is only amplified, louder now.
And even the portrayal of academia as the sort of, you know, competing for students almost, that feels like that has only grown and grown mm-hmm. in the years since this was written as well.
Yeah. And academia as a, in some ways, is another way of commodifying culture and flattening out meaning, you know. I mean, it's that you could find a situation where Hitler and Elvis are sort of mean the same thing in some way.
Yeah. I mean, that is an incredible scene in the film with, you know, simultaneous Hitler and Elvis lecture going on. If I saw one review that described it as competitive, but at the same time, it almost felt cooperative and like a duet mm-hmm. almost, that yeah. they're sort of playing off each other.
Yeah, and we choreographed it that way as well, so that it was like a dance and like a duet. Absolutely. I mean, a lot of the movie was choreographed. That scene, it's more expressive and more out front. But all the scenes with movement, we choreographed in a similar way, so that. That there was a kind of dance and song that was embedded inside the sequences.
So I mean, I know that another part you choreographed apart from the dance at the end, which I want to talk about because that was amazing, but was also the family scenes and that sense of a big kind of rambunctious family all tumbling over each other with ideas, physically tumbling over each other, getting breakfast mm-hmm. and everything at the same time. That felt wildly true to me, having come from a family of four kids myself. You know, that also had to be kind of quite carefully choreographed, I think, just to get that level of maybe ease with each other. Is that right?
Absolutely. And rehearsed. And we rehearsed it in on the sets as well, because I wanted everybody to know what's their glass, you know, particularly the kids, like which McDonald's glass do you use? Which one's yours? Where is the silverware? Which way does that cabinet open? You know, things that are somewhat simple, but they are part of our routines. When we go into our own kitchens, we it is like a dance. We know exactly where everything is. We know how to get around each other. We're, you know, you're not bumping into each other. You're in this flow of life. And the first part of the movie in particular is about that flow of life and about these routines and these rituals and ultimately these strategies that we have for ourselves so as not to confront ourselves in many cases. And but I think there's also real beauty and joy in that as well. And I wanted to express that in the movement and in the dialogue. We mic'd everybody individually so that I would have the freedom later to isolate dialogue or play it all as one sound.
Just one chaotic noise.
Yeah, one chaotic sound. I also, my direction to the kids essentially was, you're like a radio that's been turned on at the beginning of the movie, and you're going to be on for the whole movie. And whether you're in the scene or not, just assume you're still talking. And when you come back in, you're just in the middle of one long conversation.
Yeah. From some of the interviews I read with Greta, that very much happened. They would just go straight from dialogue into their conversation, back into dialogue.
They would do that, yeah, as real people as well. They would, between when we were cutting, they would go out of the dialogue of the movie and then just start talking about whatever they were talking about, and it would have the same song would be playing.
That's awesome. So tell me about these different parts of the movie, because that has got to have been I imagine the most difficult part of the adaptation process is this is a big book. It's a book full of big ideas. And you've got to try and boil this down into movie length, basically.
Right.
How do you, you know, where did you start? What did you decide to focus on as your kind of through lines?
Well, yeah. And of course, in the beginning, when I was adapting the book, that everything in the book was so exciting to me and funny and observant. So I had the first, my first pass would include so many different things. And it's really once I got through this first sort of chunk of screenplay, then I could look at it as its own thing. And then I could start working the screenplay. And at that point, it started to become more my thing or my interpretation now of the book. So then things would reveal themselves to me more as either unnecessary or superfluous or repetitive in a way that I felt I didn't need. And I would then start excising things, combining things, and then inventing even within that. But as a result, then there's so much good stuff that's not in the movie. I mean, and I would go back to the book occasionally later if I was looking for something or I remembered something maybe I cut, I thought I could put back or something. And then I would be rereading the book again and be like, God, there's so much good stuff. I didn't, why is this not in the movie? Why didn't I pick that? You know, but you know, it becomes its own thing. And you just follow what feels like now the movie.
So you could do White Noise 2 with basically all the other bits.
All the other bits, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I do want to talk about just the way it's shot as well, because you've got the sort of the disaster sequence in the sort of the middle of the movie felt very Amblin to me. It felt very kind of 80s, you know, kids, family action movie, mm-hmm. if you like. And then you have this fantastical, brightly lit, beautifully colored dance scene at the end. So you really, it felt like you were experimenting with things and just letting yourself be led by the moment. Is that fair?
Well, it feels that way, although it was all very planned. but I'm glad it feels that way. Well, the book felt that way to me. And the book uses tropes of American narratives, culture, language, and it does it in a very literary way. And I felt like my job was to find these cinematic analogs for those things. And a lot of it was the language of these movies, and often movies from the 80s, because it's when it took place. It's also a formative time in my childhood of when I was discovering movies sort of on my own. As opposed to things my parents maybe brought me to much about what the movie's about is how we've essentially, we absorb all of this stuff from entertainment and sometimes it becomes hard to distinguish between what's on TV and what's really our lives. I mean, that you see it with the family in the movie where when real danger is coming, they somehow can't, it takes them a long time to acknowledge it. The kids are ahead of it, but the parents are sort of feel like, well, this can't actually be happening. This is only something that happens somewhere else. And I think it's something certainly I related very strongly to, that feeling with the pandemic, which was, well,
can't happen here.
Yeah, it's not happening over here. It's happening somewhere else. And so I felt, well, this is a way I can express, you know, that sort of, I mean, how we, you know, just, I mean, I think it really, one of the things the movie's really about is sort of this changing idea of death. I mean, this idea that we have that death is, we make it part of our entertainment. It's the car crashes in the beginning of the movie. It's watching a plane crash in New Zealand on your television. And it becomes hard to really, you know, it's hard anyway. And this is a way that we maybe bring it closer and also keep it at a distance. And when it really comes in the form of the cloud, it, it, changes how they all go back to life, you know, I mean, and can you go back to the same strategies and rituals that you did before? And if you can, how does it change those things? And does it change those things? And in the movie, it does. And, you know, and it changes visually. The camera changes in part three. We shoot the family in the supermarket in the beginning of the movie. We essentially just move with them. It's fairly straightforward when we're with them in part three, both times that. And then, of course, at the end with the dance sequence, the camera suddenly does things that it couldn't possibly have done before. It's sort of liberated in a way. And I think that's part of what I see too is, I mean, there's a cynical way of looking at it of sort of like, oh, we're all just going back and shopping. But there's also, I feel, real beauty and joy and liberation in that we've been also something that has released us from, you know, maybe this sort of prisons that we've sort of made for ourselves. You see it with the family too. The family, essentially death is what keeps them apart and also what brings them together in the end. And Jack and Babette are closer, but they've also gone through a lot to get there and had to go into areas that they, you know, may not have wanted to go to.
Yeah, and taken some odd steps along.
Some odd steps and almost killed a man.
But, you know, it's fine. They got him to a hospital for atheist nuns.
They got him to a hospital and they're back at the supermarket.
I just thought it was so original. And like I say, just unlike anything I'd ever seen before. I have to ask just quickly before I let you go, you know, your household has also been working on a Barbie movie. Do you see any kind of common threads between that and this?
I do, actually. I mean, they were both written in the pandemic, and I think in the best way, both have a touch of madness in there that was maybe particular to our headspaces at that time.
And a bit more choreography there, I think, as well.
There's also choreography in both, yeah. I mean, essentially, both have are kind of like musicals in a sense, even when they're not literally like musicals.
Can't wait for that one. And thanks again for this one.
And that was Noah Baumbach. And it's goodbye from me. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.